This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 314 was recorded on March 10th, 2022. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Masterworks, the billion-dollar alternative investment platform that lets you invest in art by legends like Warhol and Picasso for a fraction of the cost. Economic cycles guru Lakshmana Chuthan returns as this week's feature interview guest. Lak will explain why a Fed policy error is now an almost certainty, and what ECRI's indicators portend for economic cycles in the year ahead. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when I'll be talking charts with Patrick.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Eric, this S&P 500, it's just monstrous volatility on a day-in, day-out basis. You know, 100 S&P point swings seem to be just par for the course. But the prevailing trend still seems pretty much down. What do you think's in store here for the S&P?
Well, you know, I'm actually surprised that it's holding up as well as it is. The market is continuing to trade on the war is bad logic, and I think eventually that will give way to war being bullish for the stock market. At least that's what usually happens. But for now, it's not trading that way, and I don't think this is anywhere close to over. Some people seem to be acting like, oh, it's all winding down now. It's a false alarm. I don't think that's the case at all. I think we're just getting started with this escalation of tension between Russia and the West, and I think it's likely to get worse before it gets better. And so the Fed is no longer just tapering into a slowdown, which was perilous enough. Now it's tapering into World War III. So if anything, I'm surprised by how well equities have held up here.
All right, well, let's move on to the dollar, because after last week's show, we had a huge breakout in the dollar index up toward the 99.50 area on the upside. But we had a pullback in the last few days, but still a very bullish trend. What's your thinking here? Does the dollar still have room to go higher?
Well, the war cycle is definitely very dollar bullish, and I expect that to continue. Now, I think it's very interesting to observe what happened in the last week with the United States essentially confiscating Russia's foreign exchange reserves or their dollar-denominated foreign exchange reserves. I think this is going to bring a big question mark into all of the central bankers' minds around the world, which is, wait a minute, does it make sense to allow the U.S., clearly in this case with Russia, Russia's done some pretty bad stuff here, but is it okay, regardless of what a country has done, to give one nation the authority to essentially just cancel its foreign exchange reserves, you know, at the click of a button? I think that's going to add more contention, and it's going to bring more questions to whether or not the rest of the world is comfortable allowing the U.S. dollar to continue to serve in its role as the world's global reserve currency. So I think that this crisis is going to heighten that sensitivity, and it's going to increase the imperative both for the U.S. to get its act together and figure out a digital dollar strategy that actually makes sense as opposed to just a fluffy white paper, which is all they've done so far. And I think it's going to be an incentive for other nations around the world to start looking more seriously at how comfortable they are with the U.S. having the amount of authority that it has over the financial system.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because all I have to say is, wow, that was volatility. I mean, it feels almost like the complete reverse of the when we went minus 40 2 years ago. Just huge liquidity squeezes and oil rocketing up to $130 and then giving, almost $25 back in a day. Just extraordinary volatility. I wanted to your take on this. Like, what's going on here, and is there still more upside?
Well, you said it, extreme volatility. I think at one point yesterday, Wednesday, we actually saw $10 down in 10 minutes, or at least it felt like that. I didn't actually time it. Huge volatility swings. I don't think this is over by any stretch of the imagination. It seems like we're kind of on a risk off, in the sense of geopolitical risk off cycle at the moment, with WTI trading back below $110, actually traded below $104. Briefly on Wednesday afternoon, as the market took that $10 dive down in just a matter of minutes. I think that we're going to see that the geopolitical tension between Russia and the West is anything but over, and I will be very surprised if that $130 or $131, I think it's $130.5, whatever the peak was, I don't think that's the final top. The 147 spot 29, which was the intraday high, all-time high on WTI set back in 2008, I think is definitely on the table now to be challenged. And look, there's plenty of room to get to $250 oil. I think if you look at the way that most analysts are looking at this, they're saying, well, okay, we've done our analysis, and we think that if the Biden administration puts the sanctions on Russian oil purchases to say this as opposed to that, it's going to have this effect or that effect. It's like, wait a minute, guys, forget about that. What happens when the Russian Navy has blockaded the Suez Canal and the Straits of Hormuz and has put a total lock on oil shipments every place, and we've got a military seizure of the ability to move oil? And by the way, just before that happened, we went and we emptied our strategic petroleum reserve because we're trying to fight gas prices at the pump to buy votes rather than saving it for when we really needed it. What happens when we get to the point where this really is a war and Russia is applying pressure by using energy as a tool of warfare and is blockading things? Now, clearly, we're not at that point yet. My point is, the way things have escalated and how quickly they've escalated and how quickly the West seems to be willing to continue pushing to further escalate them tells me there's plenty of room for this to keep going. And I don't know what the upside maximum is, but I don't think we've seen the worst of it yet.
So, Eric, how did the inventories come in? And like, is that a big factor nowadays in the market?
Well, the inventory was a factor for a good solid 5 minutes in the market. Crude oil drawing down 1.9 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down another 585,000 barrels. Cushing really getting dangerously close to tank bottoms now. Gasoline drawing down 1.4 million barrels. Then the really big drawdown was distillates, 5.2 million barrels, with U.S. production unchanged at 11.6 million barrels. To your question, does it still matter? Yeah, it matters in the sense that there was a big spike up in price in reaction to those drawdowns, but that was overshadowed by the geopolitical de-escalation headlines that at the moment that that happened, there were headlines circulating that supposedly progress had been made on some kind of peace accord between Russia and Ukraine. Turns out that didn't really end up being completely true. But in the grand scheme of things, Patrick, I think the geopolitical factors are going to be dominant. Inventory still matters, but not nearly as much as whether or not we're going to have a nuclear war.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because an explosive move in gold went and retested its near its all-time high. We were at 2,080 on the upper end. A little bit of a pullback, but hard to suggest that that's already a reversal. I mean, this is clearly some really strong bullish breakout. Do you think we're going to all-time new highs here?
I don't really understand why everybody, including you, is calling this a really amazing big bullish breakout. We've got, I think, the highest risk geopolitical situation of our lifetimes. I mean, this is Cuban Missile Crisis level of concern, with nuclear superpowers threatening to use nuclear force. I would expect gold to have been $500 higher in that circumstance. And to me, what I'm seeing is gold is doing absolutely nothing here. This little itsy-bitsy $200 move up that we've had since this Russian tension has broken out tells me that gold is not serving effectively in its role as a geopolitical risk hedge. That's the way I see it.
Well, let's touch on the 10-year Treasury yields, because it looked like for a little while that finally we saw a short-term peak and things were kind of calming down. But clearly, inflation pressures continued to persist. And we over the last few days have now seen us get right back to that 2% level on that 10-year yield. You think there's still more upside here and more downside on the bonds themselves?
Well, Patrick, as you say, we're back up at 2%, and this is in the face of a huge geopolitical situation, which you would think would result in a safety trade and a big move down in yields. So it says that that inflation risk is very real, and as Lakshmanachuthan is going to go into quite a bit of detail on, we've really got to ask the question now, which is, what the heck are central bankers going to do as they're facing inflation that's definitely starting to run away versus a very strong need to tighten? And it's no longer tightening into a downturn. It's tightening into what looks like the beginning of World War III. So, you know, this is a really, really big question. I don't know the answers, but I certainly think Locke's going to have a lot of interesting insight in today's feature interview.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is ECRI co-founder Lakshmanachuthan. Eric, why did we get Locke back on the show this week?
Patrick, we had Locke on the show last August, and the way I left things with him, as I said, look, normally we, you know, wait so many months and call a guest and invite them back, but just let us know when your cycles are telling you that you got something to talk about, and we'll get you scheduled then. So he wrote us back saying, look, I think there is a situation where the cycles are telling me that a Fed policy error is almost an absolute certainty. That's why we got him back. Now, by the time that we had scheduled him and a couple of weeks had transpired and we actually got him on the show, all of this war risk has erupted in Ukraine and Russia. So we're going to talk about that as well.
Well, Eric's interview with Locke is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
Abex Technologies invites you to Smarter Markets' new podcast series, Demystifying Carbon Markets. Corporate climate pledges went mainstream in 2021. Moving into 2022, these companies are increasingly focused on developing and implementing plans to turn their climate pledges into climate action and understanding how carbon markets can help them turn their good intentions into meaningful change. For many, however, carbon markets remain unfamiliar, creating apprehension over potential risks. They have many questions. What are carbon markets? What types of projects help reduce carbon emissions? How do I judge the quality of these projects? Will the carbon markets be large enough to meet net zero goals? In this series, Smarter Markets teams up with Base Carbon Corporation to bring you the architects and practitioners of the carbon markets, seeking answers to all of these questions from people who know the markets best. Episodes are available weekly on Saturdays beginning February 5th.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Lakshmanachuthan, founder of the Economic Cycle Research Institute. Locke prepared a short chart deck to accompany today's interview. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not registered yet. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Locke, it's great to get you back on the show. Last time we had you on was August of 2021. And at the end of that interview, I said, hey, you're a cycles-driven guy, so why don't you reach out to us when your cycles tell you you got something new to talk about? You reached out a couple of weeks ago before the whole Ukraine situation erupted on us, and you said you had something to talk about pertaining to an upcoming policy mistake. What's on your mind?
Right. Hey, it's great to be back, and thanks for the intro. Basically, pre-Ukraine crisis, we were just staring down the barrel of a couple of policy mistake choices. It wasn't whether or not there would be one. It was just which one do you want to choose? And to kick it off, I'd say the first one that we were alluding to probably the last time we were able to talk together is that they could be tightening, the Fed could be tightening into a slowdown and therefore be risking a recession and or a market crash. And I guess alternatively, if you took the other kind of door, they could kind of back off and get a bit more dovish And then under those circumstances, they'd be risking runaway inflation, letting that get really embedded. And so they had a very, very narrow path to try and get to the proverbial soft landing. And not even, I think, realizing that we were cycling down in terms of growth. And since then, since I reached out, that path has become extremely narrow, I would say, at this point. And I think it's not too long ago, just a few days ago. So, you know, after the Ukraine crisis kind of kicked up, you know, Powell has said that he's still on track for hiking as needed to quell inflation. So here we are. I think we're staring, Ukraine aside, we're staring at some volatility here in front of us from a couple of different angles from a cyclical vantage point.
Now, we've had some other guests on the show telling us that they think inflation is probably peaking now and likely to subside, although that's not my view. Before we get into how Ukraine changes all this, what were we talking about in terms of the inflation risk? Do you see this as a secular inflation risk, or is it just transitory but needs to be addressed now? What is the issue with inflation? How do you see that? And then after that, why don't we get into what about Ukraine? What does that mean for the whole picture?
Sure. Well, so in between transitory and secular lies cyclical. So cyclical, just for listeners, is something that is going to be pronounced, pervasive, and persistent. It's going to last for many quarters in terms of, in this case, we're talking about inflation. And so we had all the way back in it seems it's a long time ago, fall of 2020. That's a long time ago, and this is actually on the page two of the slide deck that I shared with listeners for today. You know, we had an inflation cycle upturn call, so that's not a transitory inflation call. That's not a spurt in inflation call. That's a pronounced, pervasive, and persistent upturn call, and it's very, very hard to remember back that far. You know, I really do mean that. It's because we're inputting so much information every day. It's very hard to remember what people actually real time were thinking in the moment in September of 2020. But nobody was talking about a pronounced, pervasive, and persistent rise in inflation back then. The bond market started to figure it out that inflation was a stickier issue in early 2021, I think it's fair to say. And of course, the Fed didn't turn hawkish until November of 2021. So there's a lot of water under the bridge there. Now, I think if you step back from like the day-to-day data and you look at the patterns and cycles and kind of we're monitoring the cycle very closely, and then there's the whatever the headline narrative is trying to deal with the incoming data. Now, I think the root of the problem that we have, this is pre-Ukraine. Ukraine is just putting this on steroids right now. The root of the problem is the Fed's lack of understanding of the inflation cycle. It's very different than cycles in the economy. So now I'm going to ancient history. I'm going to go all the way back to 2018, but there was an inflation cycle downturn that we flagged in the summer of 18. And this is the prior cycle. And this is well before the bond market became aware of the cyclical shift down. And also, again, it totally blindsided the Fed. And the Fed's belated response to an inflation cycle downturn in 2018 was that abrupt, what's been come to be known as the Powell pivot that happened in early 2019, following a 20% decline in the market. And in the aftermath of that event, there's some diagnosis, like what happened. You know, the Fed's trying to diagnose what happened. And they totally got it. I think they learned exactly the wrong lesson about how cycles and inflation work. They kind of rationalized what happened as a fundamental structural shift to what they would call kind of a super flat Phillips curve that would allow the jobs market or whatever to be super tight and allow the Fed as an institution to abandon any attempt at preemptive tightening to control inflation. So they just really didn't need to be concerned about any run-up in inflation. That's the lesson they learned from missing the 2018 inflation cycle downturn, cyclical downturn in inflation. So that's the background for what's going on now. That utter misunderstanding of inflation cycle dynamics is now coming home to roost with a vengeance. So they think inflation's basically, for all intents and purposes, dead. And any spurt in inflation, therefore, had to be transitory. I think most people can remember that the Fed was saying transitory till they were blue in the face about rising inflation in 2021. And in reality, you did have that inflation cycle upturn call. I mean, that inflation, an actual upturn in inflation that we had called back in the fall of, or the summer and fall of 2020. And so that's why the Fed was so far behind the curve. And now, no matter what the current circumstances are, in terms of geopolitical stuff and other commodity price spikes and all this stuff, they have to tighten monetary policy aggressively in order to quell inflation. They almost have no choice, according to Powell.
So going back to 2020, you made the call for cyclical inflation, not transitory, not secular, but cyclical inflation.
Correct.
That was happening. The Fed was slow to see that it was happening. Then we get this Ukraine situation. So now we've got a war cycle on top of everything else. You were saying previously that we've got a real problem here because the Fed is stuck between a rock and a hard place. They're really going to have a hard time balancing the need to tighten into a downturn against what could be really, you know, starting to run away inflation here. We need to do something about it. Now it's not a question of tightening into a downturn. It's a question of tightening monetary policy into what could be incipient World War III, a major, you know, geopolitical conflict situation that has a huge negative impact on the economy globally anyway. We may need to tighten into that, and there's really no choice, you're saying, because inflation's getting to the point where it has to be dealt with. That doesn't sound like a good recipe.
No, it's not a great recipe, right? So I mean, if we take Powell at his word, and I have no reason to disbelieve what he believes, or is, you know, I think he's saying what he means when he says, you know, I am set to tighten. You know, I hope the history books will put me down as a Volcker type Fed chair. And I think he was talking to Senator Shelby. He was responding to a question he had the other day. Now, going into what's happened in recent weeks in Europe, we had a high conviction call already, just a cyclical call of slowing growth. And we started discussing that growth, what we would call a growth rate cycle downturn call, publicly last September. And, you know, that view, it's normal around turning points that our cycle views are going to be at odds with the consensus. And the consensus and the Fed basically were kind of the mind that the course of the virus, right, the earlier crisis, which is the COVID crisis, will determine the course of the economy. So they, you know, that's the Fed's words. The course of the virus will determine the course of the economy. That is not our view at all, right? I think that these business cycle dynamics are much, much stronger, in fact. And therefore, but if you believe that the virus determines the course of the economy, any unexpected weakness, what we would deem a cyclical slowdown, natural cyclical slowdown, since, you know, gets blamed on the virus, first Delta and then the Omicron wave. And so on slide three of the deck, we shared something from our spring of 2021 slowdown call. And on page four, we just have a simple chart. It's not a forecast, it's a fact. It's the coincident index growth rate, which defines the economy outside our window. It's all the hard data that defines actual activity, not forecast activity. And I don't think most people realize, I don't think the Fed realizes, that growth in the hard data that defines the economic cycle fell to an 11-month low by early this year. That's coming off of a, so it's below a 2% growth rate now, but this is before any of the recent stuff has happened. And that's down from a peak of a very strong growth rate of 15%. And that is a, you know, already it's a cyclical slowdown. The problem is that there's no forecast of an upturn, right? And then we're piling these problems on top of something which is already slowing very, very rapidly. And I think as people today are looking in the rearview mirror, they're going to belatedly see the extent of this slowdown. And then they're going to look to the Ukraine crisis and what's going on. And very quickly, and we're starting to see this, you know, I think in some headlines that there's guaranteed recession, right? There's a quick swing to the R word. The consensus forecasts, I think, are a little bit more benign so far. They've probably not adjusted enough. They've just come down a little bit for Q2. But in the again, from our vantage point, there's a much more disciplined way to monitor what's going on with the economy, which is these forward-looking data that we look at. And right now, the idea that we're in a growth rate cycle slowdown, it's not even a debate. It's already a lot of water under the bridge. It's a done deal. The question is there any path to a soft landing, or is it a done deal that we go into recession? And that's, I think, going to be determined, you know, in the next probably just a month, a couple of months. It could go either way. So that's what we've got to look forward to figuring out.
Okay, Locke, so we already had this perhaps assured slowdown, this need to tighten into that slowdown, the inflation problem, and now we've got the Ukraine situation on top of all that. What does that lead to in terms of your outlook from here, now that we've covered where you were before we saw this Ukraine situation?
Yeah. Well, look, we have a process, and this process is developed over, you know, actually, I think it's right now it's about a century. it's at least three generations going on four. If you reach all the way back to defining what a business cycle is, that work was done a century ago by our predecessors. Now, to literally know if there's a high risk of a hard landing, a recession, we're going to need a little bit more data. We don't have that data in hand, but we know what we're looking for, and this is in terms of forecasting, not in terms of nowcasting. Okay, so we've been studying cycles, as I mentioned, longer and more reliably than anyone I know, and the way we understand how recessions occur is a bit different than what people may infer. I think a general feeling is that if something really, really bad happens, a negative shock, it can cause a recession. And that's why there's such a fixation on identifying potential shocks. And most recently, it would be like a rampant virus or a spike in oil or commodity prices driven by war. Those are the kinds of things people are focusing in on and looking at charts and saying, hey, this chart lines up and it's a recession. But really, these exogenous or external shocks are part of recession dynamics. You know, they are part of recession dynamics, but a critical part of the puzzle is the endogenous or internal market forces, the cyclical market forces. And getting a good read on these internal cyclical forces is you know, not that straightforward. It's complicated. It's been the focus of our work for a long time. The key is really to determine when. It's a period of time, and it's not always happening, but to determine when the economy is vulnerable to external shocks and when it isn't. There's plenty of times when it isn't vulnerable to external shocks. Now, since we're talking about war today, the last time a war triggered a U.S. recession was in 1990. So in February, this is when I had recently joined the research group as a young kid. In February of that year, we were all alone in predicting a recession because our research showed that a recessionary window of vulnerability had already opened up. This is in February of 90. Now, at that time, and it'll be, nobody will really remember this, but at that time, the economy had been chugging along and nobody saw any recession risk. I mean, we were saying recession, nobody else was saying recession. So on the very day that Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, that's on August 1st of 1990, we knew the related oil price shock would definitely trigger the recession. And to give you a sense of how long it took for the consensus to catch up, the Fed didn't cut rates until late October, 3 months after the recession began. So that's a real example of war triggering a U.S. recession and some of the key dynamics around that event. Going back further, I think most would agree that the December 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor was a much bigger shock, right? That's a big one. But it didn't trigger a recession before wartime spending had a chance to kick in. It took a while for the spending to kick in. But that shock did not trigger a recession. And the reason was that the economy was in a cyclically resilient state in the lead up to the attack. There wasn't this window of vulnerability that we talk about. Now, you could switch from, I think, you know, in my lead-in when I was saying why I called you, I was saying, hey, the Fed's tightening into a slowdown and either they're going to get a recession or a market crash. So I wanted to talk about market crashes. Now, in 1987, you had a 23% drop in the market in one day. And everyone expected a recession to occur as a result of that, except us, which landed us on the front page of the Wall Street Journal then. And again, it's because there wasn't the cyclical window of vulnerability. In more recent years, that's all ancient history. I wanted to give you those big ones so you get a sense for the power, the size of this idea. But in more recent years, in 2016, we went hard against a consensus that predicted that the Brexit vote would trigger a recession. And we, again, because the window of vulnerability wasn't open in Britain, in England, said it wasn't going to. Similarly, India, we do a lot of international cycle. I mean, we're watching 22 economies around the world. So India, we're also watching closely. I have to say this slowly because it's hard to fathom. They demonetized 86% of their cash overnight. That's kind of a big deal, right? Everyone assumed a recession would follow, but we were right in saying that it would not. Again, the window of vulnerability was not open to this massive negative shock. The Reserve Bank of India, the RBI, cited our analysis, Eckery's analysis, in their justification for not cutting rates as the market had expected. And sure enough, India didn't go into recession. So I'm giving a bunch of these examples because the critical insight that we have is not what the shock is that will trigger the next recession, but when the economy is vulnerable. And answering that question of when is key. That's what we're focused on doing as well as we can. Now, when we look at the forward-looking indicators today, with the data in hand, that is not the case at the moment, the window of vulnerability. We go back to the beginning of our discussion. The Fed is essentially promising a policy mistake here that may help a window of vulnerability to open up. To know that, we have to see what our indicators do in the next month or two.
Okay, so the indicators are not really showing that window of vulnerability, of economic vulnerability right now. The concern is what the Fed has said, you think essentially guarantees that they're going to take us into that situation.
Yeah, and if you go to get a sense, though, I think a picture speaks a thousand words. To get a sense, that coincident index growth rate slide on page 4 of the deck shows you, you know, we're not downplaying this downturn in growth. That's a serious downturn in growth. it is, it's approaching zero. And that's where windows of vulnerability can start to open up. We do not have signs of any reacceleration in growth. You may remember, right, that not too long ago, people were talking of quite high interest rates. They were talking of the roaring 20s. 2022 is going to be the roaring 20s, all these other things, right? I mean, there's just no, this is 180 degrees looking the other way.
Locke, let's come back to inflation, because you said that we already have a backdrop of a cyclical inflationary impulse that we're fighting. That's for starters. Now, I'm going to make the argument that the ESG movement and what I think are some misplaced goals of the ESG movement have created a situation in energy that is a setup for higher energy prices even before you consider the inflationary backdrop. And we agree that the inflationary backdrop is there. Now the situation with Ukraine has the potential to dramatically exacerbate that. So I think that we could see, depending on how this whole war cycle plays out, we could see markedly higher energy costs. If I'm right about that, what is it going to mean in terms of the feedbacks? The way I look at it, there's plenty of scope here to go over $150 oil price. Between $150 and $250, I think, is very much in range. And I do not think the economy can anywhere close to tolerating that kind of increase in energy cost. And so to me, it's a setup for a really serious problem. How does that fit your analysis, and how does it play in with everything else we've talked about?
Yeah, thank you. Those are excellent points, and I agree with your observations. Okay, you started off with the kind of unintended consequences, I guess, to put it nicely, of ESG on commodity prices and the way that it's impacted the supply of commodities. Now, when we're doing cycle work, all up until now, we've been talking about referring to cycle work, slowdowns, accelerations in growth, and then inflation. So we're not saying anything. We don't have a particular insight or original research on the supply side. We can observe it, and we do. And ultimately, right, these prices are a function of both the supply and the demand side. And so the ESG movement has constrained the supply. So everything else being equal, prices going up. We've got demand growth coming down. And so we have been in a global industrial growth slowdown for a while now. And that is why industrial commodity price inflation had, past tense, been falling since last spring until recently. Even though there's the ESG-related supply constraints. And what we have now with war breaking out is a massive supply shock across a number of commodities, including energy. But to be clear, demand is still slowing. Demand is not accelerating here. It's slowing here. So there's this, whatever, it wasn't, I guess you have to go back and look a month or two ago, but people were looking around for this post-Omicron kind of reacceleration. That's just not there. And so the idea that inflation is going to crimp and hurt is completely consistent with cycles. It's not unusual for inflation to peak inside of a recession. That's not unusual. I think you can look at 08. 2008, we're inside a recession. Recession begins in December of 07. And probably second quarter, you've got oil running at 140 handle, maybe approaching 150. Now, my mentor used to joke with me, because economics is a little bit of a slippery kind of science, right? It's not a hard science, let's say. That one of the what he thought was one of the only economic truisms was that recession kills inflation. Okay. We can observe that if we want. If you look at past recessions, you'll see that. But then in particular, you might think of Volcker, right? Who gets invoked these days, and Powell invoked him the other day. And of course, you know, you had two recessions at the beginning of the 80s to kind of break the back of the 70s inflation. So I can't forecast by analogy. We don't, that's not how we do it. We look at our system and sequences of leading indicators, but I could totally imagine that happening. And I would look for the indicators to confirm the leading indicators to confirm that expectation. And then of course, we'll get confirmation from the coincident and the lagging data. But the idea, and you, I think you can, anybody listening, right, can kind of attest to the maybe somewhat subconscious or maybe conscious experience of seeing a higher price, you know, maybe begrudgingly paying it, and maybe somehow or another rationalizing not spending quite as much, right? Because of some feeling that you had about paying these higher prices. Now, when that happens across the economy, you're getting a slower demand growth, if growth at all. And we're seeing that when you look at real wages, you look at real spending, those things are cycling down hard. There's still some semblance when you look at the nominal numbers, but when you look at the real numbers, people are already tightening their belt, and we know that that's going to happen. We think we know. We're pretty sure that we know that this is going to keep happening, given what we're seeing on the radar screen. And when we get our updated leading indicators, you know, we'll have some confirmation of that.
Locke, let's translate these views to what they're going to mean for markets. Obviously, we've got a lot of changing factors, and it's impossible to make an exact forecast. But in general, let's start with equities. What does everything that we're discussing in these cycles mean for equity markets?
Well, bottom line is, you know, relatively speaking, it depends. Everybody has a different risk profile, but relatively speaking, it's been risk off for a bit now in terms of equities. And I say this because during growth rate cycle downturns, which we're well inside of a growth rate cycle downturn, during those periods in the QE era, the post global financial crisis era since 2008, double digit market corrections are all associated with periods of slowing growth. And so I have a chart on page 5 of the chart deck. It shows just S&P 500 against cyclical downturns in the growth rate of the economy as defined by the coincident index, which is on page 4. And I also threw on one of our leading indexes. This is what we call a U.S. short leading index. It leads by a quarter or two over growth rate cycles and turning points. And you see the short leading index, you know, it's about as clear as it can be. It's a pronounced, pervasive, persistent decline. You see the growth rate cycle downturn shading has been developing for a while now. And you see we've got a double-digit correction in the market since earlier this year. And that is normal in this post-GFC world that we live in. So until we enter the white shaded areas, which depict periods of growth rate cycle acceleration, you need to be prepared that you could hit significant corrections, double-digit corrections, in terms of the equity exposure that you have. You could have smaller corrections anytime, but these double-digit percentage point corrections are all clustered inside growth rate cycle downturns.
Let's move on to the bond market. Most people associate a downturn with reducing yields, but they also associate increasing yields with inflation. So if we've got unstoppable inflation and a downturn, what's that mean for bonds?
Yeah, this is where, you know, I'm so grateful for our kind of approach to our framework, because it allows for cycles in growth to be seen independent from cycles in inflation. And I think it's reasonable to kind of think about cycles in growth affecting real rates and cycles in inflation affecting inflation expectations, and the combination of that should add up to overall yields, nominal yield. And right now, I think with the belated recognition of the growth rate downturn risk, right? Not for the cyclical reasons that were correct in anticipating and actually chronicling the slowdown that you see on chart on page number 4 of the slide deck. Real rates have come down. And inflation expectations, as you can expect, with the big spike in commodities, industrial commodities in particular, have spiked very recently. But when you add it up with the weakness in the real rates, we've got the nominal, say, 10-year yield kind of coming off the highs, right? The Fed being behind the curve and having to make up for a lot of stuff is probably helping those real yields from falling further for the time being. And we'll have to see how those different moving parts evolve here. I think the Fed is, I think they're on tap to hike this, what is it, in a week or so, or it's this month. So then we'll see what the reaction is to that.
Let's move on to commodities. I think it's very interesting. You know, we've seen in this inflation cycle, huge moves up in crude oil, in copper, even before we got to the war cycle. Then with the breakout of this tension between Russia and Ukraine, now we've got the grains going through the roof. It's interesting, though. Gold, everybody's favorite inflation hedge, really hasn't moved all that much, despite huge moves. You know, the price of oil has more than doubled in the last few months. Copper, I don't know that if it's doubled in the last few months, but certainly in the last 12 to 18 months it has. And, you know, we're just up, not even really making a new all-time high on gold. What's going on?
That's a, you know, I'm not entirely sure how to describe gold in this inflationary environment. Sometimes it's counterintuitive, right? Where it'll go the opposite way than you would expect on the surface with inflation. I think probably right now in the moment, it's just your safe haven risk off asset to sit in. But with the rise, it's supply and demand on commodities. So for right now, with demand where it is at the moment, if you take the snapshot, there's just not enough supply. And so the price is, you know, it's a moonshot. Not unlike, you know, perhaps we have to confirm this, but that happened in Q2, at least for oil, of 08, when you're inside of a recession. And then it turned around with a vengeance, right? So two things, we have to watch two bogeys, right? The supply and demand. Demand, we think we have a pretty good read on. It's cycling down. We know the vector. We know it's going down. The only question is it a soft or a hard landing on demand? That's the only open question, and the risk of a hard landing is growing. So then you look to the supply side, and the high prices, in theory, ought to be bringing on alternative supplies, and we'll see how that transpires. But you know, I am reminded of the old quip that the cure for high prices is high prices, and I think that we shouldn't be surprised for that to happen here. There's a lot of belt tightening in terms of people's demand.
Well, Locke, I can't thank you enough for another terrific interview. Before I let you go, though, tell us a little bit more about the services you offer at ECRI and how our institutional investors can find out more about your products.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for the time. We work with institutional clients on cycle risk management. You know, they have a lot at stake, and they have, you know, they all tend to have pretty good processes in place, but they can be taken to another level by incorporating a sophisticated understanding of cyclical risk. And having done that, at the end of the day, it's really just about conviction at the cycle turns, the tops and the bottoms, right? And so when everybody says the sky is falling, can you turn and go the other way? And we work with them to build conviction to go against the crowd at the right time. Got a lot of international scope in what we're doing. We do have indicators for Russia and for Poland, cyclical indicators. So those are in demand at the moment. And you know, we don't normally name our clients, but I thought I have an okay to name one, which is TSMC. you know, we have a lot of money manager clients, but we have some corporate clients too. And so they've become better known of late during the whole COVID crisis because of their work with the products that they have with semiconductors. They've been clients for over two decades now. And from the strategy and the tactical side of things, not the technological side of things, but from the strategy and tactical stuff about managing the business, I think we've been part of their success. And, you know, otherwise we're working with a lot of fund managers, investment committees, hedge funds, big family offices. And I'm reminded, I think the crux of everything is that I'm reminded of something that Wilbur Ross observed several years ago about just the reams of information that we all have at our fingertips nowadays. And he quipped that the value of data is pretty much going to zero, while the value of an insight is going to infinity. And so I like to think, for us at least, that we're really focused on the insight part.
Well, Locke, give us a shout when you've got more insights, and we look forward to getting you back on the program. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. If you're rethinking your portfolio like most investors right now, it's time to pay attention to one asset class Americans are overlooking. The Wall Street Journal even called it one of the hottest markets. I'm talking about blue chip art. That's right, contemporary artwork has taken the financial world by storm. It outpaced the S&P 500 from 1995 through 2020. And some hedge fund managers have allocated over 20% of their portfolios to art. Now you can too with Masterworks. They're the investment platform that recently sold a painting for a staggering $2.9 million, giving investors a net return of 31%. So you no longer have to be a billionaire to invest like one. Get priority access to their latest offerings at masterworks.art/macrovoices. That's masterworks.art/macrovoices. See important disclosures at masterworks.io/disclaimer.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Locke back on the show. You know, it's interesting that we're talking recession, or risk of recession anyway, this soon after the last recession. Usually the business cycles last much longer, but it's like, this kind of boom-bust cycle seems to have been so accelerated, and the risk of policy error is so great. It's such an interesting time in the markets.
Well, Patrick, I agree. And I think the big takeaway for me from this interview was, look at what has happened as a result of the Russia-Ukraine situation. We already had central bankers just really between a rock and a hard place, where they've got to tighten into a downturn, which is hard enough. Then you got runaway inflation. Boy, what do you do? Well, now you're exacerbating all of those factors. They need to worry about inflation worsening much more quickly now with this geopolitical risk, and they've got everything else to tackle. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens in terms of monetary policy going forward. But let's talk some charts. Listeners, you'll find the download link for this week's postgame chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you haven't registered yet. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says looking for the downloads. Patrick, let's talk charts. Page 2, S&P 500 continuous futures chart. What do we got going on here?
Well, listen, for the last couple of weeks, I put that 200-day and 50-day moving average on there just as a reference point to sort of understand that, you know, when we were in a pretty distinct bull market, those levels were barely ever violated and the trend stayed so prevailingly higher. And it really goes to show what kind of a correction we're in the midst, where we're now on a sustained basis holding below these moving averages. Just we continue to have a deep correction that continues to break to lower lows. every rally continues to fail. It is interesting because on a compared to a lot of global markets, the S&P 500 actually has been holding up. We'll a little bit later in the chart deck talk about some of the different global equity markets. But one of the key things I think for me to watch for going into Friday and into the next week is whether or not the market can get back above 4,300 on the S&P, and more importantly, above 4,400. So far, every rally has been failing. And if that trend continues, the path of least resistance is there for the S&P to even test 4,000 or lower on this. And really what needs to happen is the bulls need to neutralize the sell cycle by at least stabilizing the markets. And those are the two levels above where I think we have to clear those hurdles in order for the prevailing sell cycle to be neutralized. And if every day that we stay below those hurdles, the more likely it is that there's still one more leg lower. The interesting question to really though ask, Eric, is like, is this a correction or is this a bear market? Because if it's just a market correction, traditionally 2-3 months are usually typically the length of a normal market correction that usually is 10 to 20% in nature. We have basically met that criteria. And so the interesting part here is that if the market maybe has one last little washout event, if this is not a bear market, and this is at least for the short term, just a correction, that might be a place where traders could look for a buyable low moving forward. I mean, the only way you can legitimately keep staying bearish this market is if you believe that that recession is imminent and this is a bear market and not just a correction. And that's such an interesting puzzle to solve here in the coming weeks. I don't know if I have a strong conviction answer yet, but this is such a fragile key moment in the markets in the coming weeks.
Well, it seems to me like there are some bearish arguments here. I mean, we've got Charlie McElligott a few weeks ago telling us that he wouldn't expect to see a bottom until about May. And if I look at your chart here, it looks to me like at the rate things are going, we're about a week away from the 50-day moving average crossing down below the 200-day moving average. That would be the event technicians call a death cross. Is that significant? It seems to me like if the bottom is May, there's probably still a fair amount of downside to come before we get there.
It's interesting because I'm sort of torn with the death cross signal because, you know, think of what a moving average is. It's the average price of 50 days or 200 days. In order to get a 50-day moving average to cross below a 200-day moving average after an uptrend would take an extraordinary amount of selling like we've seen. And so the market tends to be incredibly oversold at the time when that signal comes. And so the only time that signal really in my mind has true meaning is if this was a bear market, because if it crossed over, there will inevitably be some sort of a rally that's going to come on the other end, and it would really mean that those rallies would be failing and rolling over for that to be a sign that there's some sort of a bigger sell cycle. But there's almost no, in my opinion, market timing value to making an investment or trading decision based on the death cross. I think that though it does demonstrate just how weak the markets have been that we're getting to that point, right?
Let's move on to the volatility index on page 3.
Right. And this is the interesting part. We have seen, like, go back beyond the very start of this chart where we show the COVID crash. But beyond that, every time volatility has risen above 30, marked some sort of a tradable low during the bull market phase. And rarely would the VIX stay on any sustained basis above 30 before quickly retreating. And as volatility contraction occurred, it actually gave a huge bullish tailwind to the markets and would drive the counter rally the other way. But here we are week after week after week with the VIX holding above 30, just because this is now where volatility premium needs to be priced in these periods of uncertainty. And the fact that we're seeing this, I actually don't think that that's bullish at all. The fact that volatility continues to be priced this way, a lot of vol targeting funds that use average volatility levels are going to be degrossing their risk exposure, and the selling pressure is going to continue to come under that. I'm actually quite surprised at how long we'd sustain, and I it. And every day that the VIX stays above 30, I think actually only supports the idea that there needs to still be one more washout event in the market on the downside.
Patrick, let's take a look at the Euro-US dollar cross, which is the biggest contributing factor to the dollar index.
Right. And this is one that we've been tracking, and the breakdown of the euro was significant. It's not shown on this chart, but we've now retested 2020 lows on that euro. And it's interesting in the bigger context of the last 5 years, the euro had some lows put in around that 104, 105 level down below. If the dollar remains in this trend and acts as a safe haven in this period of uncertainty, one has to think that if this rally on the euro fails, particularly below this kind of 111, 112 area and rolls over, the downside risk of a double bottom retest of 108 and or even one more leg lower down towards those 105, 104 lows is a real risk. And that could see a situation where the dollar index goes and prints north of 100 on the upside as it goes and it retests its highs as well. It's certainly the path of least resistance, and the geopolitical backdrop certainly supports the case that these trends will still stay in place. On page five, what I also wanted to add here was just look at that US dollar yen. What we've seen was over the last kind of month, it was very much a euro-driven move. But whether it's the pound, whether now it's the US dollar strengthening against the yen, we're now seeing the other major currency crosses starting to show some, that the US dollar is taking inflow. And it will be interesting on this US dollar yen chart whether we see that breakout to a new fresh year high. If it does, then we could see the yen heading to 118 to 120 on the upside, and it that would certainly contribute to even a much bigger whip in that dollar index.
Let's take a look at gold futures on page six. You're calling this a massive breakout. I don't get it. What's so massive about this breakout?
Well, this is, first of all, a weekly
considering chart. What's going on, that we're talking about nuclear war threats.
No, listen, I think that what we're seeing is while there is nuclear war threats and all of these different things, bull markets do take a little bit of momentum to build up and really get going. Gold, after a year of being in a sideways purgatory, has disappointed investors so distinctly that many people have lost the taste to want to go to the gold markets. And what the gold market needs to continue to build is the FOMO. As these breakouts happen and there's big money being made, the easiest way to get a real bull market going is to have everyone realize there's big money being made and they don't have any. And so while we had a definite breakout that is now advertising that there's a new gold bull phase, one of the most important things to watch over the next couple weeks is, will the buy on dip characteristic now dominate? As we get these $50 and $100 an ounce pullbacks that are very typical in the natural ebb and flow of market moves, will we continuously see buy on dips occurring? And more importantly, will it break out a new high? Those are the types of things that the media starts to really bring this to attention. And one, all you need is it to be start being talked about as much as, you know, a crypto was a year ago, or any of the other things like oil over the last many months. And if we see that build up, then we could see a new bull trend that pushes gold to even towards 2,500 over the remainder of the year. Now, we did test the previous high, and that is commonly a place where gold bumps its head. So I actually think the next 1 week is going to be pretty important. Will we see that the price action is well defended up here? Where you would be right about your skepticism is if we quickly saw a drop back to 1,900 or lower, that would almost certainly derail this breakout and really put to question whether or not that bull run is there. I personally think it's a really good breakout, and my bias is that we're going higher.
We'll see what happens. Let's take a look at page seven, oil futures.
Yeah, this is where you can comment as much as I can. The one thing is that there was a huge give back from 130 all the way back to 105. When I look at where retracement levels are and things like that, even though the pullback was so severe, what happens is that corrections tend to be the most violent, and especially when you're upping margins and people are so leveraged in prevailing trends, that could have been just a washout, no different than if we recall back in November when we had just a quick $10 wipeout on the downside back in November. That was just one big margin call. Oil was such a popular trade and everyone's so convinced it's going higher that this type of a drop could have just simply been liquidity. What I'm going to be watching into next week is whether oil can crawl back to 120 and beat it. If it does, maybe your call of 140 to 150 oil is still on the table. The most disappointing thing that would happen is that we see that buyers just don't have any interest anymore in buying these dips, and we see failed rallies, and that I don't think is here yet. And so I'll be watching next week whether or not the bulls can beat that 120 level. What are you watching on oil?
Well, first of all, I want to be clear that there could very easily be a further downside correction. I mean, to go back down and test 95 again would not in any way invalidate the uptrend. So what's going on here is we got to 130 on panic fear about nuclear escalation of geopolitical tension between Russia and the West. We got back down below 110 on some headlines about supposed negotiations of peace talks and so forth that, frankly, I'm not convinced are really as meaningful as people are reading into them. I don't think this has ever been about Ukraine. This is a much bigger, broader Russia versus the West conflict that I think is only just beginning. And I think there's lots and lots of room for more upside. But there's nothing to say we don't go another $10 down or more than that before we start going up again. So it's treacherous, treacherous trading. It's tempting to say better time to trade with options instead of outright futures. But of course, you're going to be paying through the nose for volatility on those options. So, I'm still long. I haven't added to my position. If we get another dip down below 104 or so, I'll probably start adding to my long position. And, I'll take profits on more peaks over 130. Unfortunately, I think we're headed there unless there's a major de-escalation of political tension. And unfortunately, I don't see that coming.
The volatility in the entire commodity space is just gone ballistic. I mean, everything from that nickel squeeze to here on page 8, I have that uranium chart breakout. Obviously, the moment you say the word sanctions to any commodity and disruption in supply chains and all these different things, immediately the response has been a substantial and clear bullish breakout. In this case with the uranium, it looks using that spread physical uranium trust chart. This one's on the TSX, the one I have here. It's breaking to a fresh high, and it'll be really interesting to see what, I was quite bullish uranium over the last couple of weeks, and it's really got a great start to this move. But very similar to gold, if these breakouts can stick, it will be really interesting to see whether they create new multi-month trends rather than just a couple week little punch higher. One way or another, very bullish chart. Maybe a little bit overdone on the short term, so it could pull back the way gold did on an intraday basis. But uranium certainly looks pretty bullish here.
Well, I think uranium was a bullish chart before the whole Russia conflict came up. But people have to realize we get something like half of all of the enriched uranium in the world is exported by Russia. If we outlaw that, or if Russia blockades it and just stops making it available, there is no other source for the rest of the world to supply its nuclear power plants. And in a commodity like uranium, where the price of the fuel is such a tiny part of the overall cost of producing energy, where most of the effort goes into the safety measures and so forth, there's not a lot of price sensitivity. So the price of uranium can quadruple in order to deal with the supply chain issue of not being able to get it from Russia anymore. And it doesn't really put that much of a dent on the cost of operating a nuclear power plant. So the upside for uranium is just to the moon here, I think.
Anyways, what I wanted to move on to here, Eric, is I have this the Euro Stock 50 index chart as well as the Nikkei 225. So looking at Japan and Europe, and one of the things I wanted to highlight is that while the S&P 500 and Nasdaq charts have been bearish, they are nowhere near as bearish and as clearly in a downtrend as many other global developed markets. What we continue to see is the Nikkei breaking lower highs and lower lows in a very distinct downtrend, wiping out, you know, close to 20% of its value on the downside. The Euro stock was in almost an outright crash mode on the downside, wiping out, you know, 20%. Obviously, very oversold conditions that have warranted a small bounce. But what's interesting is that what we seem to be having, at least on the surface, is a rotation out of a lot of developed markets into the U.S. equity markets, almost like a safe haven trade. And maybe that's actually holding U.S. equity up a little bit more. I mean, that's a speculation. I don't necessarily have a lot of evidence, but it certainly feels that way. But what is clear and what one has to step back and look at is the vast majority of the world stock markets are in sell mode. And they are very ugly charts. And it'll be really hard for the U.S. equity markets to buck the trend and punch new highs or something in reverse unless we see some distinct bottoms really develop in so many other developed markets around the world. It'll be really interesting to see whether, let's say, for instance, that Euro stock that had that really strong bounce this week, whether that marked a low. Well, certainly that's something to watch into next week.
On page 11, we've got the 2s-10s treasury spread. That's a measure of the steepness of the yield curve. What's going on here?
Yeah, well, listen, I wanted to put this out.
Non-steepness, I should say.
Exactly. And so what I just wanted to highlight here, obviously, we had Lack on the show, and really the idea that we might be moving toward a potential recession. Again, no one's calling one for sure here yet, but one of the long-standing signals for it is an inversion of the curve. And whether you're looking at the 2s-10s or whether you're looking at the 2s-5s, we're seeing outright flattening approaching zero. Now, have they inverted? You know, does it mean that something is imminent? No, but this trend is not giving up. And we continue to see flattening occurring over and over again here. And it'll be certainly something to watch whether this kind of lines up with some of the things that Locke is looking at.
Let's move on to page 12, high yield credit spreads. That's junk bonds, the kind that have very serious default risk, trading at only 4% over treasury yields. And that sounds like a high number these days, although it used to be like 10% plus.
Right. You know, well, I mean, the one thing is that, okay, yeah, they're not near 10%, but I don't think we have the same crisis or anything going on at this stage. But one thing that is important to highlight is that we've now seen these credit spreads widen more than they've been at any point in the last like year and a half. And they are really starting to show some stresses in the market. And, you know, while we can speculate that the S&P might put in a short-term low, it's certainly not the conditions where one would expect that. Like if we're seeing stresses in bond markets, stresses in the credit markets, in the high yield markets, stresses in the currency markets, these are things that are going to potentially keep pricing risk into the markets. And it's something that I would think is a bit of a warning. And in my mind, in order to really start to speculate that a low might be in on the stock market, I'd like to see that correspond with some sort of a turn in these credit spreads, which have simply not let up yet.
Listeners, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. You can get the information on page 13 and 14 or go to bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Masterworks, the billion-dollar alternative investment platform that lets you invest in art by legends like Warhol and Picasso for a fraction of the cost. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as the slide deck for Locke, as well as the post-game chart book that we just discussed. There's also a link to a number of articles we found really interesting, and so you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that's Eric spelled with a K, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.